So here we are on Sunday afternoon, and I thank you for your dedication today and yesterday, if you've been able to come both days. So in one of Buddha's most well-known discourses called the Honeyball Discourse, he said, what we frequently think about and dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. The shape of our mind shapes our world of experience. So that's a remarkable uncovering of the Buddha's, a remarkable discovery. So as we develop mindfulness, we are actually shaping a mind that is skillful, that is making space for wholesome qualities to be nurtured and developed. What we frequently think about and ponder upon becomes the shape of our mind. The shape of our mind shapes our world of experience. So we've been developing continuity of practice this weekend. Moving about, going in, going out, walking in the woods, having meals. No, life is one continuous opportunity to practice attending to this mind, body, heart, and also of recognizing how we are constantly in relationship to the world around us. The habits, the conditioned habits of mind are often very difficult to see, but with continuity of practice, they actually become more visible. Oh, there's grasping. Ah, I hadn't seen it before. That wanting to fix. There's delusion. Oh, going into a Starbucks, that's just what I need. You know, or that little irritability, that subtle irritability. I thought it was going to be sunny again. Or if it was going to snow, why didn't it really snow? The things that we want, so much wanting. My partner, Patrick, he wanted to live in a house with a wraparound porch. What an interesting ambition. When he moved into my house, the best we could do was paint my back door. Not even the red that he wanted, but more of a kind of pink. So interesting, isn't it? I mean, it seems like we come into the world, we take our first breath, we make our first cry, and then we start wanting. It's poignant. I mean, it's actually essential to our survival to want love, to want warmth, to want food and nourishment. So our practice is about befriending this mind, befriending the mind that wants, the mind that is dull and confused, and actually creating a kind of default in the mind of kindness towards our experience. Oh, there you are again, eating chocolate late at night. What did you think you were doing? It's just this, a friendliness to be a good companion, a wise companion, a generous companion, a discerning companion through this journey, and to model that for others. You too can befriend your own crazy mind. So yesterday I invited you to consider what brings you to this practice. In a sense, I think all the answers I proposed are just aspects of the same intention to live with ease, to live with greater fearlessness and even courage, and to fully liberate the mind from habits of greed and aversion and delusion. But I also think we practice in order to live without regret, in order to have a happy end of life, so that we can look back at our experience and say, I loved well. I gave what I could give. I savored my walks in the woods. I listened to the birdsong in spring. I watched the waves on the shore. I shared a cup of tea with a friend. I listened to her story. Some years ago, my old French teacher came to visit me in Victoria, Maggie Duchenne. She had grown up in a small village north of Paris during the Second World War. Her father was the mayor, and it fell to him to receive the Germans when they came and occupied France in 1940. Maggie had amazing stories to tell of her childhood, growing up in that very difficult time. And she had developed, through that experience, this capacity to invite people into their own strengths, into their own gifts. She taught at École Bilingue in Vancouver. And when I did my practicum to be a French immersion teacher, I spent a few weeks in her classroom. And she had gotten to know the 25 or 26 children. And she would say, Sophie, la danseuse, or Jacob, inventeur. She gave them each a little nickname or appellation and helped them to see themselves. Oh, I am a dancer. Oh, I am an inventor. I am an artist. She gave them her reflection and her view of who they could be in the world. So when Maggie came to visit me, she had retired from teaching. She had spent some years doing individual counseling. She'd studied the Adlerian method of psychology. And we were sitting in the house where I was house-sitting in James Bay, and Maggie began to speak in French. It was amazing to hear her speak in French. Sometimes I would say, Maggie, you speak French so well. But of course, it was her language. But the philosophy and the wisdom that poured forth from her, and I was taking notes, Maggie, tu es incroyable! And I thought, at some point, I want to film Maggie or record her. So that intention sat there, and some years later I went to see her in Vancouver, and I asked my nephew to come, and he had been studying film and he had a camera, And he set up his camera and we sat by the window in her apartment near English Bay. And I said, Maggie, parle-moi, dis-moi, describe to me your philosophy of education. And she said, l'amour, c'est l'amour. You must love. And it was true. It was exactly the way she taught. She taught through love. And even those difficult children who, for whatever reason, you know, they were restless, they were rambunctious, they were rude, she still loved them. So, you know, Maggie was an extraordinary role model to me. And now when I teach as a teacher on call in French immersion classrooms, it's really her example I call upon. And I set myself a very simple challenge for the day, not to lose my patience. And oh boy, I work hard. Oh my gosh. It's amazing, actually. I mean, I don't know if I could do it if I were in the classroom every day. But if it's, you know, one day here and one day there, it's quite something. And recently, I told stories at the art gallery. And three groups of children came to hear me tell stories of generosity. And one little boy with paint on his face came up to me. He said, I know you. You were in my classroom. And I said, oh, yes. And well, I'm Kieran. And he told me where he went to school. And I said, oh, we had a good day, didn't we? He said, yeah, we had a good day. And I remember it was a kindergarten classroom that was totally wild. So our practice, you know, it's to see how the love that we experience in our lives, that we offer and receive, that can manifest in our relationships, in our relationship to ourselves, in our relationship to our minds, in our relationship even to these forces of delusion, these habit patterns of greed and aversion that arise through a lifetime and lifetimes of conditioning. So how can we relate with love, with friendliness, with care to our own minds? It's an amazing practice. So we lay the foundation of our practice with mindfulness. And I also think we lay the foundation in our commitment to living an ethical life. So these precepts of non-harming, they're not moral laws, rules laid down. They're training guidelines. And what's so beautiful about that is that in each of these precepts of non-harming, there is a place of exploration for us. Oh, okay, what does it mean to be in relationship to living beings that we consider pests? You know? It may mean at times that we actually have to set traps, or worse. I mean, if your home is being devoured by termites, what do you do? It may not be that easy to simply move somewhere else. I remember reading about a practice in Indonesia of placing offerings of little crumbs, bits of fruit at the corner for each of the four corners of a house. And when asked about it, the local person explained that these were offerings to those creatures that might actually destroy the house, but it was being in wise relationship to them instead of being in conflict. So these precepts of non-harming are training guidelines. I undertake the training to refrain from harming living beings. And this is such a broad, expansive undertaking. And we can interpret it and explore it and refine it in any way we like. And we can also turn it around. I undertake to support the flourishing of living beings. Growing a garden. Caring for a patch of flowers. Being aware of those in our community who might need support. Caring for an elder, reaching out for someone who may not be able to get out. I undertake to support the flourishing of living beings. And we can't exclude ourselves there. What supports our own flourishing? To know ourselves, to know what really supports us being who we want to be. So I gave this talk the other night, this storytelling evening about elephants, and one of those who were present, he sent me a link to a TED talk given by the Prime Minister of Bhutan. So he was speaking at a conference in 2016, and he described his country's mission. You know, not gross national product, but gross national happiness. But also his country's mission to be carbon neutral. In fact, to be carbon negative. And to preserve the great forests on the mountainsides of this remote Himalayan country, and where they export clean energy, and they've created a fund called Bhutan for Life to fully enable them to transition to alternative energy sources, and to even help farmers so that they can use electricity to cook rather than cutting down trees for fuel. And, you know, he showed some beautiful images in his talk of these magnificent forests. Immediately, greed arose. Oh, I must go to Bhutan. But then he showed us a glacier. He showed us one image taken 20 years ago, another photograph 10 years ago, and a photograph more recent. The glacier that had become a lake, that had become a raging torrent. And he said, actually, you should know there isn't just one glacier like that in Bhutan. There are over 700. And then he showed us the damage and destruction as that glacier melted and flowed down and overran its banks and destroyed farmland. And he said, we are a tiny mountain kingdom, but climate change is affecting us as well. And so he said, my motivation in coming to speak to you is not, you know, purely for the good of all. It's a very selfish motivation, but also a desire to encourage the world, the countries of the world, to form their own, you know, versions of Bhutan for Life. That is a deep commitment and a financial commitment to preserve forest lands that are carbon sinks, that collect CO2 and become the lungs of the planet. So, to support the flourishing of life, and how wonderful to walk through the grounds here and to see the trees that have been planted, cedar, pine, So, the second precept is an invitation to consider very specifically, how do we relate to the resources of the planet? I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. Do I really need to make that trip to Bhutan? Maybe not. And also to creatively reframe this training, I undertake to live more simply. Or simply, I undertake to practice simplicity and generosity, to share the resources I have. And it's wonderful to see the various communities in Victoria who have formed to welcome refugees and who have, you know, spent hours, you know, helping them get established. So generosity is really a reframing of that second precept. And the third precept, you know, I undertake to refrain from sexual misconduct. It can be understood in terms of respect. I undertake to respect relationships and the commitments that people have formed, and to honor and respect my own commitments. The fourth training is about right speech. And really, this is such a wonderful place of practice for us. To speak the truth, to speak what is necessary, what is useful, and at the appropriate time. What a lot of discernment that will take. But to actually think, oh, I'm up to that. I'm up to that challenge. Some years ago, I was teaching at an elementary school in Victoria, and one of my students, his name was Vray. Isn't that amazing? His parents had called him True. True, that's the French word for true. Vray. And his sister's name was the Greek word for truth. And he laughed. He said, yeah, we're the truth family. But what's so interesting is that he really did radiate sincerity and truthfulness and honesty and purity of heart. Oh my goodness. I adored that little boy. And it was very hard to say goodbye to him at the end of the year. And a few weeks after the school year ended, I was up at UVic, and he was at a day camp there, a soccer camp, and I stopped to watch him, just from a distance, watched him, and he saw me, and he came running, and he gave me a big hug. It was just amazing. So, you know, to really undertake truthfulness, and to see how that transforms us, you know, even how we use speech, maybe to boast a little. Oh yeah, I did a 3-month retreat. You know, it's like, you can boast about anything. So I wanted to read a poem. Let's see. David White is a poet and facilitator. He says, this is, his poem is called Loaves and Fishes. This is not the age of information. This is not the age of information. Forget the news and the radio and the blurred screen. This is the time of loaves and fishes. People are hungry, and one good word is bread for 1,000. So can we see this fourth precept from a different angle? I undertake the training to speak words of wisdom and appreciation, words of gratitude. Forget the news and the radio and the blurred screen. This is the time of loaves and fishes. People are hungry, and one good word is bread for 1,000. And maybe that good word is also just silence. So we've been developing a continuity of practice, and who knows where it will take us. You know, it's transformative. It's like mindfulness is with you. The potential for mindfulness is with you everywhere you go and everything you do. Dipama. So one of her students, Katrina Schneider, said, during my 2-month retreat with Dipama, her focus in our interviews was always on areas of my practice that needed work. For instance, what particular emotions were still strong? Or during what sitting or part of a sitting was concentration weak? How was I dealing with drowsiness at the end of the day? She didn't discourage enthusiasm about what was going well, but she always wanted to know what was inhibiting continuity in the practice. What was fascinating about Dipama was that she lived with that steadfastness, that steadiness, or continuity. It didn't matter if she was having lunch, going for a walk, or dealing with her young grandson. She did it with strong attention, marked with a sense of ease. I was reminded of Dipama's approach to practice when we recently had a desert turtle living in our yard. The tightly woven fence never seemed to create an obstacle for this slow and steady creature. To keep track of him, we put a band-aid on his shell with our phone number on it. Days after each disappearance, the phone would ring and we would be awestruck at how far and wide we would have to drive to retrieve him. When we placed him back in the yard, the moment his feet hit the ground, he was beginning his next journey. It was like that with Dipama. One could see a profound continuity and effortlessness. She taught me that grace is really economy. Not too much and not too little. So Utejaniya, a teacher that my teacher Steve Armstrong has been practicing with, he speaks about light awareness. And I like that image. Awareness as just something very light. Not something that's deliberate, but something very light that we carry with us. So a couple of poems. So one task that is inevitable, even though we say nothing is inevitable, but one task that is inevitable, I think, is the dishes. Would you agree?
Yes.
Do the dishes sometimes seem endless? So what about, Thich Nhat Hanh speaks about mindfully washing the dishes. Here is a poet, a California poet, who writes about that. He calls it the Zen of housework. I look over my own shoulder, down my arms, to where they disappear under water, into hands inside pink rubber gloves, moiling among dinner dishes. My hands lift a wine glass, holding it by the stem and under the bowl. It breaks the surface like a chalice rising from a medieval lake, full of the gray wine of domesticity. The glass floats to the level of my eyes, behind it through the window, above the sink, the sun, among a ceremony of sparrows and bare branches. The sun is setting in Western America. I can see thousands of droplets of steam, each a tiny spectrum, rising from my goblet of gray wine. They sway, changing directions constantly, like a school of playful fish, or like the sheer curtain on the window to another world. Ah, gray sacrament of the mundane. So maybe when you do the dishes tonight, there will be a shift there. Raymond Carver, mostly known for his short stories, but also wrote poetry. The Window. A storm blew in last night and knocked out the electricity. When I looked through the window, the trees were translucent, bent and covered with rime. A vast calm lay over the countryside. I knew better. But at that moment, I felt I'd never in my life made any false promises, nor committed so much as one indecent act. My thoughts were virtuous. Later on that morning, of course, electricity was restored. The sun moved from behind the clouds, melting the hoarfrost, and things stood as they had before. My thoughts were virtuous. Later on that morning, of course, electricity was restored. The sun moved from behind the clouds, melting the hoarfrost, and things stood as they had before. So it's recognizing that we come in and out of moments of clear seeing, that we will be overcome by grasping again and again and again. But actually we're planting this seed here and each time we sit to be more familiar with those mind states and to glimpse them more readily. Ah, grasping, there you are again. So we can ask ourselves, what supports my practice? What helps me to settle? And this is a wonderful thing to think about often. What supports my practice? And I know that an orderly environment supports me and supports clear thinking. And I'm very motivated, more so than I used to be, to simply put things away. You know, to have one clear counter, to deal with the mail when it arrives, you know, to put those stacks of books back on the shelf. It's amazing, a bit of space in the visual environment actually supports a bit of space in the inner environment. Sitting down to have a meal. Making a deliberate effort to set a place. I was telling Rhonda and Sandra about this book I read as a child. You might have read it. It's called... I think it's called The Orphan by Frances Hodgson Burnett, who wrote The Secret Garden. It's about a little girl who's an orphan who comes back to her attic, which is usually cold and damp, and finds that someone has lit the fire in the grate. There is a tray, a tea tray. There's a pot of tea steaming and warm buns. Someone has thought of her and created this beautiful array for her. Wow. Well, we can do that for ourselves. You know, set a place. Assist ourselves in being mindful in the sacrament of taking nourishment to support our practice. Set a place, light a candle, step out of the room and step back. Oh, who remembered me? I did. So, what supports your practice? Poetry, stillness, music, companionship certainly, conversation with wise companions, being in nature, visiting those who are ill or at the end of their lives could be a tremendous support to your practice. So, the last of the five precepts is around our relationship to intoxicants. I undertake the training to refrain from intoxicants which cause heedlessness and cloud the mind. So how are we going to interpret that? Is it surfing the internet? Checking email one more time. And how can we turn that around and say, I undertake the training to support my practice by discovering what conditions are conducive to mindfulness? What conditions actually nourish and feed me so that I can be mindful. So this is a poem by Denise Levertov. It's called Witness. Sometimes the mountain is hidden from me in veils of cloud. Sometimes I am hidden from the mountain in veils of inattention, apathy, fatigue. When I forget or refuse to go down to the shore or a few yards up the road on a clear day to reconfirm that witnessing presence. Witness. Sometimes the mountain is hidden from me in veils of cloud. Sometimes I am hidden from the mountain in veils of inattention, apathy, fatigue. When I forget or refuse to go down to the shore or a few yards up the road on a clear day to reconfirm that witnessing presence. So let's just sit for a moment and experience the pleasure of each other's silent company and support. Feel the deep nourishment of this practice. honor the wisdom and the generosity of your own heart. Thank you for listening.